Hi, it's Mike Pownall, and welcome to the latest Veterinary Business Matters podcast. I'm really excited about this week's podcast. I had a great chance to revisit and chat again with Dr. Betsy Charles of the Veterinary Leadership Institute, and I wanted to talk to her about a subject she brought up at a conference I attended when she talked about bullying and shaming in the veterinary profession. And I thought that was an interesting subject, something I've been really interested in, as you'll hear about in the podcast. But we got off onto a tangent near the end talking about, you know, the education of our veterinary students. And I'll leave you in a bit of suspense because there's one thing that we talk about near the end of the podcast that I honestly think is probably one of the most eye-opening thoughts I had about our profession, that if we can alter our how we teach students, the potential and our opportunities for our profession are huge. It's almost that missing link everybody's been talking about. You know, how can we improve the profession? How can we engage people to use vets more? And I think Betsy hit on something, so I'm not going to say any more. That's a suspense for you to listen to it to the very end. Before we jump into the podcast, I just want to mention that the Veterinary Business Management Podcast is brought to you by Oculus Insights. Oculus offers practical insights and solutions in the veterinary business training they offer to veterinarians, practice managers. They find that their insights and solutions make an immediate and long-term positive impact on the business, professional lives, and personal lives of their students. Their design uses professional educators with customized learning directed to the veterinary audience that is flexible to the ever-changing nature of our business. Oculus Insights offers four types of programs. They have the three-year veterinary business school with a degree in veterinary business management. They have the four-day in-depth veterinary business subjects, veterinary business summits. They have the one-day, one-subject veterinary business workshops, and there is one coming towards the end of January on inventory management in Denver, and one on change management in Frankfurt in the beginning of February. And finally, they offer business consulting. Oculus Insights, offering approachable and personalized veterinary business training, keeping you inspired, confident, and control for you, your business, and your future. You can find out more about Oculus Insights at oculusinsights.net. And now on to the podcast. Enjoy. Hi, I'm Dr. Mike Pownall, and welcome again to another podcast for Veterinary Business Matters. I'd like to welcome back Dr. Betsy Charles, who participated in one of our podcasts a few years back. But as you'll soon hear, there's something I want to chat with Betsy about. So, Betsy, welcome. Tell us about yourself.
Thanks, Mike. It's so good to be here. I'm honored that you have had me back on. So a little bit about me, so you know who you're talking to or listening to. I am a radiologist. I started out in equine practice for about 6 years and then just loved imaging and lameness, went back and did a residency. And so now just do imaging, both small animal and equine. I am also on the faculty at Western University of Health Sciences, where I am responsible for the radiology aspects of the curriculum. I also help with some of the equine stuff, and then I do leadership training for our students as well. And then the final hat that I wear is that of the executive director of the Veterinary Leadership Institute, which is a not-for-profit organization that is pretty much, we are trying to help the veterinary profession develop the skill sets that will help them be successful in the profession. And by success, that's kind of a challenging word to define, but whatever it is for each individual person, we're trying to give them the skill sets that will help them reach their goals.
That's great. And so let me give some background. So I was at a conference that you were presenting at in Ontario earlier this year. The OVMA, Ontario Veterinary Medical Association, had the Great Ideas Conference, and lo and behold, you're there because you all have great ideas.
Thank you.
But I was sitting in on your presentation, and something you talked about struck me. And I said, I need to talk to Betsy about this because, yes, I am seeing this so often too. And boy, this is a bone I want to pick. So
awesome. Awesome.
You started talking about bullying and shaming in the profession. And I was like, that is something we need to talk about. So can you give me some background on where that came from?
Yeah, so this whole idea of bullying in the profession, and I, you know, it's a topic that I think has been on my mind for a lot of years, and it's just been probably this last year and a half, 2 years that it's really come to the forefront of my the things I'm talking about in leadership and the things I'm trying to help people with when I'm at a conference or et cetera. And so I can't remember the context I was sharing it in at the conference, because it's something that I've been talking about a lot. But I think that in our profession, so I think those veterinary professionals who are listening, unless your head has been buried in the sand, you recognize that we're kind of at an important crossroads in our profession, where wellness and leadership are kind of crossing, and this whole idea that we are struggling as a profession from a well-being standpoint has gotten a lot of press lately. And so I think that for me, we've been talking about these kinds of concepts at the Veterinary Leadership Institute for a lot of years. So since 2003, we didn't really call it wellness or well-being back in the day when it started, because nobody would pay attention to you if you talked about wellness, but they paid a lot of attention to you if you talked about leadership. And so we called we developed this program, Kathy Ruby and Rick DeBose developed a program called the Veterinary Leadership Experience, where we started talking about these skill sets that are not tied to technical skills. So initially they were called the soft skills, the non-technical competencies. At the VLI, we call them essential skills. So they're the skills of emotional intelligence, communication, conflict management. How do you interact with people such that the outcomes of those interactions are successful? All those things that we don't get any training for in veterinary medicine at medical school or at veterinary school. And I've been involved with this type of training for a long time. And I started, as I've been going through this for the last 10 to 15 years, I think that what I found is we're equipping our students, faculty, private practitioners, et cetera, with these skill sets, but then they get into this culture, this environment, where those skill sets are really, really challenging to use, because we've got a culture that is, I think, rooted in perfectionism, rooted in a inability to fail, an unwillingness to fail. And so I started just paying attention to, okay, I'm giving people, I'm talking about all these skill sets, and then, part of it is my own experience. I did really, really well in veterinary school, loved it, thought it was great. And then I got out in practice and I found myself struggling to deal with some of the stresses associated with being a veterinarian. And part of that was my internship was really a challenging year for me, because you couldn't make mistakes. You were pushed really hard. And I didn't really know how to cope with that. I didn't know how to fail. I'm kind of rambling. I'm trying to set the stage a little bit, but I think that we've got this culture in medicine, and I think it's both medicine and veterinary medicine. So human medicine, veterinary medicine, where we have created, this culture where you have to be perfect. You have to be right. You can't be. And here's the word I'm going to use. Here's the words that I've learned through my reading, research, and interaction with the mental health professionals who work with veterinarians specifically. This idea that you can't be vulnerable and have it be safe. And so then as a result of that, you feel there's this whole idea of shame. And so I think that at OVMA, the conference that you're referencing, I had just started to kind of open up the conversation with veterinarians as I was presenting, like, do you feel like you can be vulnerable within the veterinary profession? Is it safe to do so? And what I'm finding, or at least in my little, kind of initial foray into that conversation, was, no, I don't feel safe. I don't feel like I can be myself. I don't feel like I can be vulnerable. And as a result, I've developed all these coping skills that allow me to be a perfectionist, be, a superstar, so that I can manage who I am within the profession. So that's kind of a little background.
Yeah, and you know, and that's great because it's where it comes from. Me is that I have been in meetings, small meetings of veterinarians of peers, and you know, at CE events, and there may be 30, 40 people, and you know, somebody will bring up an opinion, and another vet will just smack them down, and I'm like, wow. Well, that wasn't very respectful. Where is this intellectual give and take that we're talking about that we should have? You know, we see it in some listservs that vets are involved with where people are really hesitant to engage because they're worried about, you know, online bullying, shaming, and that there doesn't seem to be a tolerance for discussion. So I guess that's one aspect in terms of how peers play together. I have seen it we have a lot of new associates that come on with us. They've all done internships, and they share stories about, you know, the expectations of perfection that you talk about in their internships. That was paralyzing, absolutely paralyzing.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it goes back to, and I knew you and I were going to be talking about this, and I went back to it. You know, I remember when I was in vet school and I graduated in 2001, I used to love going to pathology rounds. And it was fun because you'd see this intellectual sparring, which was great because the patient was dead and they could have a great discussion. And, you know, but I also thought that that was, they demonstrated to the students that were participating that this kind of behavior was okay. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were some people there that there was great intellectual sparring and it was fun. Then there was just blowhards, mm-hmm, who were not very nice to their colleagues and were pompous and had great egos. And I was like, well, this, you know, we all look up to our elders. We look up to these people in elevated positions. This is how we're supposed to behave. And I thought, so this comes from somewhere in our profession. So I wonder if it comes from school or it's reinforced in internships. I don't know. I mean,
well, so for me, you're asking the perfect question. And I think that we're starting to have some answers. And here's what I learned. I've been talking about these things. How do you create safe environments? And because I'm a faculty member and I teach radiology, and radiology can be a really challenging subject because I'm asking students to see things that they can't really see. It can be really challenging to put yourself out there and be vulnerable when I ask you to tell me what you see. And so I've been experimenting a little bit in my classroom with this whole idea, but here, let me take you on the journey that I've been on in the last 6 months. So the AVMA decided that, you know, wellness was a big issue, and we're kind of putting it in this, you know, this overarching umbrella of wellness. And so they held a round table in, I think it was January or February of this year, and invited several people to come to this round table discussion. We all flew to Chicago to meet and have a discussion about, you know, this quote unquote crisis of veterinary well-being that we have in our profession. And I was there and I was struck by, so there's about 30 or 40 people sitting around the table or sitting in this room, you know, kind of in a circular table for a discussion. And I was struck by the fact that here we are talking about well-being and we had two mental health professionals in the room. Everybody else in the room were veterinarians, various executive directors of VMAs. We didn't have... I want to be careful because I think it was amazing that the AVMA took it upon themselves to convene this meeting. Excellent first step. But as I was sitting there, and I think it's because of my involvement with the VLI for so many years, I'm just like, we've got people who know how to do this and who know what's going on, and they're not in the room, and we need them in the room. We don't even know if we're asking the right questions to get to the bottom of this, you know, of this situation with this crisis in well-being. So after that meeting, I was a little frustrated. I was excited because it was a great first step, but I was also frustrated because I'm just like, we need, like, there are veterinary mental health people who have been working in the profession for 20 plus years, and they know what's going on. There's no question they know what's going on. So I went after that meeting, I called my mentor and the founder of the curriculum. She wrote the curriculum for the VLE, Dr. Kathy Ruby. I called her on the phone. I said, I just feel frustrated because I feel like we're missing your voice. We need the mental health professional voice in this conversation. loudly and clearly. And so she said, yes, I agree. We've never really, you know, we haven't formed the veterinary, the counselors, social workers, et cetera, that are working in the schools and private practices. We've never really gotten together. So I said, well, let's do that. We need to get them together and we need to start talking about this from your, looking through your lens. So we convened another think tank. It was called, we called it the Wellness Think Tank. And we invited, I think there were 10 to 15 people, most of them mental health professionals. The VLI hosted it mostly because we just wanted to give them a space to kind of come together and brainstorm what they were seeing. It was an amazing meeting to be a person who just got to sit on the sidelines and watch them talk, because they were talking about things that we haven't even begun to think about in terms of, you know, they started using all this terminology that I was unfamiliar with at the time. I have since become more familiar with it. And I want to be very clear. I do not have any advanced training in mental health. I'm not a counselor. I'm not a social worker. I think I have been working in this field and kind of that whole idea of leadership. My advanced training is in leadership, and in my master's program in that subject, there was a lot of personal growth that happened. So I think that leadership and well-being are you can't separate the two, but I just want to be
They're intertwined.
Yeah, they're totally intertwined. And I'm sure with your training, you know that if I'm going to lead well, I have to be a healthy person. And so...
Well, you need to have a high level of self-awareness to be a good leader. And when you have self-awareness, you start finding out, these are areas where I can be better and to be a good empathetic listener.
Yeah.
You got to be very self-aware.
Totally. And so in my program, we did a lot of exploration into my history, my family, all kinds of stuff in terms of how do I show up as a leader? And so that's where my interest in this whole well-being piece comes in. But as I sat there listening to the counselors and the social workers, they're talking about adverse childhood events. They're talking about attachment theory. They're talking about all these things that they see routinely, perfectionism, the shaming culture of the training of medicine, whether that's human or veterinary medicine. It was just a really interesting conversation. So then we put out a white paper after that meeting, and I'd be happy to email that to you. We've emailed it to all the veterinary schools, and they kind of, it's a summary of what happened at that first meeting. Well, then they had the second, so then the Wellness Summit, which just happened about a month ago at Colorado State. They had their second think tank meeting, which they opened up to a broader audience of mental health professionals in veterinary medicine. And they've started talking about some of these issues. Now, here's what I think is really interesting. What they're finding is, and these are all hypotheses that have not been tested yet. It's based on their anecdotal evidence of the people that they see in their offices from a counseling standpoint. We have inadvertently, I think, been selecting for high performers who tend to be perfectionists, who are very afraid of failure, very afraid of making mistakes. And a lot of that comes from family upbringing, your family of origin. And so what kind of pressures did you face in your family of origin? The interesting thing about veterinarians, and this is going to be, I think the data will bear this out, that veterinarians are different from physicians in that early in our childhoods, and I'm kind of a poster child for early in our childhoods, we had trouble with attachment to people and we attached to animals when we were young. And so our coping mechanisms were not people oriented, they were animal oriented. And it's pretty interesting because I've started talking about this with my audiences and the small groups that I lead. And it's pretty fascinating when you start to look at, you've got these high achievers that don't really necessarily like to chat with people to uncover their problems, issues, whatever. They connect with animals. And so we're lacking a skill set for that self-awareness, working through things with people. And then as a result, we get burned out because we don't have the skill sets that can help us. And then those types of people, and I am one of them, when we are training the next generation, we've got all this shame, all these issues in our background or our past that we haven't necessarily dealt with appropriately or adequately. And it feels, it's that idea of shame. And I'm a big fan of Brené Brown. I think every veterinary professional should read every book that Brené Brown has ever written on, because she talks about...
I know who you're talking about, so maybe just share, because I think her last book was all about failures we have made and yes. How we deal with failures. I can't remember the title of it off the top of my head, but...
Yeah, so so Brené Brown is a social worker whose research interests are shame and vulnerability. She came to the forefront of, I think, everybody's awareness due to a TED Talk that she did that's been viewed, I think, now over 25 million times, where she started talking about shame and vulnerability. And she talks about this whole idea of being vulnerable, and vulnerability is not a weakness. Vulnerability is actually a strength, which I don't think we have embraced in veterinary medicine. So long story short, I think that we as a profession don't understand how to be vulnerable. And because of the shame that we feel, wherever that shame comes from, it's different for everybody, but all of us have it. And the way we deal with it, I think, is telling of how we are going to get along in the world. And then go in, if you're a high performer, perfectionist, and perfectionism to me, I like Brown's definition of it. When you're thinking about perfectionism is doing things so that other people will think that you're okay. You know, it's others focused instead of personally focused.
I want to be the contrarian right here. So we're talking medicine, we're talking about veterinary medicine, and we're talking about perfection. And so, you know, we have a profession, both of them, where perfection is expected of us by our clients as much as colleagues. Or the lack of perfection has often terrible consequences. So how do we reconcile the fact that, you know, we need to be the best that we can, we can't slough off poor performance because of these consequences? So how do we marry the two?
That's a great question. And I think when you start to look at the data, and again, this is getting a little outside of my area of expertise, but when you start to look at the data, and the PLIT has great, AVMA PLIT has great data on this, that it's not, actually, it's bad outcomes are not the things, that those aren't the things that cause problems with clients. It's the way those outcomes are communicated. And so there's a skill set associated with, you know, with communicating about the realities, the black and or the grayness of medicine that we're lacking in our profession, because we don't communicate well about, I mean, people are going to make mistakes. Patients are not going to respond to the therapies in the way that we thought. And I think that your ability to communicate about that is what allows people to be comfortable, not necessarily comfortable, but to recognize there are risks associated with procedures. There are things that are going to happen that we have no control over. And I think that's part of our issue, is we feel as veterinarians that we do have control over them. And if something goes badly, that is a result of something that we did. Now, every once in a while, it is going to be something that we did, but we're doing the best we can with the information that we have. And so I think wrestling with that whole gray, you know, we want medicine to be black and white, and it's really quite gray. And we're taught in vet school that making mistakes is bad. Unless you can get into, like, what you were talking about at pathology rounds or mortality, you know, M&M rounds, I think that's what they call them in human medicine, mortality, morbidity rounds, where we're talking about what happened, what could we have done differently to allow for a better outcome. When you have a platform where you can talk about those things and you can recognize that no matter what we did, the outcome would not have been good, or we could have changed things to lead to a different outcome. Those things, just having a space and an ability to talk about that, I think is important. And I don't think that we do that well. And just the fact that we would think you've got to be perfect, like that's not going to happen. And so
that you're just setting yourself up for disappointment because that is unattainable. Yeah. Absolutely unattainable.
And just the ability to talk about those things, right? Like I have students right now who, I went to a school, and whenever I go to a school, usually talk about leadership. And then I also try to talk to equine imaging whenever I get the chance. And I was with a group of students and I put up a radiograph and I asked them, tell me what you see. And I think this is a great example of just the very beginning, that it's kind of the tip of the iceberg. I said, tell me what you see. And there's probably 30 students in the room and nobody said a word. And I'm good with silence. So I just sat there and I'm like, no, tell me what you see. And finally a girl in the front row raised her hand and she said, well, we don't really do that here. I was like, what do you mean you don't do that here? You don't. And she's like, well, we don't really offer answers because we'll get yelled at, or, you know, I mean, essentially what she was saying is we'll get, you know, what you were talking about, kind of, you know, the blowhards who just will get made fun of, we'll get shamed, we'll get embarrassed, we'll get humiliated. So we don't really offer up any ideas. We just wait for the professor to tell us the answer because that's the safest thing to do.
That is like one of the scariest things I've heard about our educational system in a real long time. I mean,
yes.
You just imagine what you're graduating from that unnamed university. And as somebody who likes to hire vets, I mean, those people are almost unemployable.
Right. But I've been to over half of the veterinary schools in the country, and that is a common theme, that we are scared to say the answer because we're afraid that we're going to get humiliated, shamed, or embarrassed. And I mean, you can see that in the listserv stuff that you talked about before, you know, or that you alluded to, that there's this bullying and this idea that there's one right answer. And if you made, you know, if you did something and there was a bad outcome, that somehow you're a terrible veterinarian. And I just don't think that that's true. I think we're making, you know, we have limitations placed on us by clients, financial constraints, diagnostic constraints, all of those things. And we're doing the best we can to do the best thing for the pet. But that's what's ingrained in us in school. And then I have a hypothesis that the professor that shames, humiliates, or embarrasses people is fighting their own shame with shame.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah. I 100% agree with you. I mean, it's nice to have a little bit of maturity and you can look on these things and sort of like, this is their issue, not mine.
Yes.
But when you're 22, 23 years old and these are your people of influence, yeah, you don't necessarily have that perspective, and it can be debilitating.
Well, and I can say, having gone through a residency training program later in life, after having been in practice for 7 years, it doesn't stop when, you know, I was 40 years old in the middle of my residency, and I still had, you know, you have those, I call them old school. They're kind of that baptism by fire where they just, you know, they say things that are, you know, you ask a question and they'll say, well, I can remember asking a question, why did you prioritize your differentials like that? Because I had prioritized mine differently. And so I was trying to learn. And I said, why did you prioritize your differentials like that? And, you know, I felt like I gave a good defense. And he says, because I said so. Well, that doesn't help me.
Wow.
That doesn't help
me. That doesn't help you at all.
I need to know what you were thinking and what your process was. And he's like, no, you don't. You just need to know that I said so, and that's what the answer is. And I was just like, okay, I'm 40 years old. You're talking to me like I'm in second grade, and this isn't helpful. And you just learn, and pretty soon you learn, I'm not going to ask any questions. I'm just going to take, you know, what he or she said, and I'm going to try to figure it out on my own, because if I don't, then I'm going to be humiliated. I mean, and that was happening in front of everybody else at round.
Yeah.
So you don't.
Yeah, that feels, that helps.
It's just,
that's a constructive, nurturing, educational environment.
Right. And it's interesting because I've started talking about this whole idea of shame and vulnerability. And I gave a couple of talks at our school, and I had, after I started talking about this, I had a colleague in my office, and he kind of came at me a little bit, and he's like, how dare you talk to our students about shame and vulnerability? You're just making them weak. And I said, no, I'm not making them weak. And he's like, well, if you're not going to, I mean, I think you're making them weak and you're lowering the bar on performance. And I said, okay, no, I'm not. Actually, what I'm trying to do is create an environment where I can actually raise the bar because they feel safe enough to be innovative and try things. But it's just, there's this disconnect. And I think it's mm-hmm. we fight shame with shame, and we don't know how to deal with the experiences of our past, the training that we have. And I still do it. I still struggle. Because that's how I was trained.
For sure. And I think if we look at, I mean, this is the way that vets been taught forever. And so, you know, we never take the chance to step back and go, is this the right way? And if you're in a department, and just like you said, if anybody, you know, steps off the line or colors outside the lines, you will be addressed. So let's just toe the line. So it's self-perpetuating, unfortunately.
Yes. Well, and it's the other thing that I think is interesting is it used to be, like, I've heard people say, you know, change will happen one funeral at a time. You know, as you get the old schoolers out of the system, then the system will change. And I just don't, I've now been in academia.
I don't buy that at all.
Yeah, I've been in academia long enough. Because, and this is what, again, this is my hypothesis. I haven't done any, you know, studies to prove this, but the system won't change because the people, in order to be successful in the system, you have to adopt the strategies of those who have not yet retired or passed away. And so by the time you get into the decision-making space, you have adopted the strategies of the system. And if the system is broken, your strategies are going to be broken, and then it just perpetuates itself, which is why I think we still have this old school mentality of shame and kind of that bullying, you know, that whole idea that you can't be wrong. You can't, you know, I try really hard when my students put something out there, I ask them to describe something or try something. I'm never going to say, well, what are you, an idiot? You don't know how to describe that. I'm never going to say that. I'm going to say that was a good try. This takes practice. It takes time. The only way you get better is to put yourself out there. And in putting yourself out there, you're going to make mistakes. And my hope is that you learn how to do this while you're in veterinary school. So when you get out into practice, the number of mistakes that you make is less. But you're still going to make mistakes when you get out into practice.
And I mean, right now I think you and I are perfectly aligned, but I can just imagine people listening to this podcast and people are going to say, oh my God, just suck it up. It's a tough business.
Yes.
We are babying these kids. I mean, already, I mean, the comments that go on the listservs about the kids and how, you know, how much we have to baby them. And I guess this goes back to that same, mentality of the old timers, of whether it's an equine vet or whatever, is working 24/7 and just, you know, it's that, you know, stiff upper lip and just carry on and until you become a fatality or you become one of the people that our profession is so prone to lately. I mean, when you find out that Australia, the veterinarians have the highest rate of suicide of any professions, there is something going on here. And I don't think we can blame our clients or the struggles of interacting with our clients. I think we have a challenge within our profession that we need to address. So with that being said, so let's say you are going to blow up the system and, you know, create the vet school of your dreams to train students. How do we do that? Because I always like, you know, we can talk about the issues, but let's start throwing some ideas out of how to make the solutions happen.
Well, I think you start by rewarding appropriate behavior. And I think as a person who has been in academia, you reward appropriate behavior. And so that means that if you have somebody on your faculty who is bullying students, bullying colleagues, they don't get to do that. And so, like, you have to have a system that rewards the appropriate behavior. And the other thing, I think, I was just at Texas A&M, and I will give Texas A&M a huge shout out right now. I just got a chance. Our VLI board meeting was at, we were at Texas A&M, and I got a tour of their new teaching and learning facility. And what struck me as I was going through this amazingly beautiful, immense center developed or dedicated solely to the teaching of veterinary students, the thing that struck me was they have departments of people who are not veterinarians, but who are experts in their field, helping the faculty develop teaching and learning resources. So for me, I was at Auburn a couple months ago, and I was talking to the faculty, and I had probably 30 faculty members. We were talking about shame and vulnerability, and I asked at the very beginning of my talk, I said, how many of you have advanced training in education? Zero. Zero people have advanced training in education. That is a huge problem for a college of veterinary medicine. Right? We don't have people who, so what I was impressed at Texas A&M is they have a whole department of instructional technologists whose PhDs and master's degrees are in instructional, you know, digital technology, creating learning resources. So their faculty don't have to figure out how do I do all this tech stuff. I just bring you the concepts, and then that department helps me develop the resource. They have a whole department of PhDs in education and curricular design. You know, they're talking about curricular design with people who are trained in curricular design, not a bunch of veterinarians who think they know how to do curricular design, people who actually have advanced training in curricular design. So when you say, how would I design it? I'm not sure. I know what kind of environment I would want to create so that learning could happen. But I would want to have a curricular design PhD. I'd want to have an instructional technology person helping decide what are the and a mental health professional who is helping. You know, this whole idea. There are some schools. Students are in class from 8 to 5 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
Solid.
Yeah.
That is.
That's how I went to school. That's how they.
Yeah, and if you go to the educational, the PhDs in education, they will say that is a horrible way for adult learning to take place. Horrible.
When I did my MBA, I did the executive MBA, it was such a unique experience because not all of them, but a large part of them, the difference I would call them is they're professional educators. Regardless of the subject, they were educators. And I didn't know that learning could be so much fun.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you had people who taught us in vet school. I mean, it was shameful that these people were up there teaching us. There were some exceptional ones, but some of them were just like somebody got the short end of the straw and they were, you know,
yeah.
God love them, poor people. They're doing their masters and all of a sudden like, okay, you got to teach this class on physiology. And they're like,
Right, exactly.
And so to have professional educators was the light bulb that went off that like, oh man, that makes the biggest difference in the world.
And
so kudos to A&M.
And it minimizes the amount of time that it takes your students to actually learn the material. And so I think there are so many things. And again, I could hear the critics in the audience, you know, already they're just like, oh, they're just giving them this and that and the other thing. They just suck it up, buttercup. You know, that's the, I actually had somebody in a live audience say that to a student. That was a fun conversation to try to facilitate, but, it's not about making it easier. It's about making it more efficient. It's about helping us as a profession move forward into innovative ideas. You cannot be, I mean, when you listen to Brené Brown, when there's a funny story that she tells where there's a Fortune 500 company wants her to come and talk to their employees and because they want, you know, their employees to be amazing and magnificent. And she said, and then they said, but can you skip the shame and vulnerability stuff and just tell us what we need to do? And she's just like, no, actually you can't skip the shame and vulnerability stuff because unless you know how to do that, you're never going to create safe environments for people to be innovative. And that's where I feel sad for veterinary medicine because I think, gosh, how much further could we go as a profession if people felt safe to share their ideas, to bring their full self to the table? I just don't think that we allow our colleagues, our students, our practitioners to do that. And then we wonder why we're burned out and we've got compassion fatigue. And I mean, I do think that the mental health professionals are onto something in that we've got some unique baggage that we bring into the profession. When I was at the first think tank meeting, one of the things I like I want to know who are the people who are thriving. So we kind of drew this bell curve. I wish I could draw it for you. So if you draw a bell curve, there's the tail end where you've got a subset of students who come into the profession who have significant pathology and are going to need help. Hear me loud and clear. I'm not saying they shouldn't come into the profession, but when they do come into the profession, they're going to need significant support in order to be successful. And then you've got most of us fall somewhere in between the bottom and the top, which is we're high achievers, we're perfectionists, we come in with some imposter syndrome, we need some skill sets that are going to help us be successful. And then there's that top group. And so these are the people I'm interested in. Who are the people who are thriving? And I asked that of the social workers and the counselors, and they said there's some, again, this is anecdotal. But we had a combined 200 plus years of mental health experience in the veterinary profession in the room. So we've got, it's not just a few stories, it's a lot of experience. The people who do well are the people who have a life outside of veterinary medicine. The people who do really well in veterinary school or thrive in veterinary school are, a lot of them are second career people. A lot of them have children. So they are, their whole world isn't vet med. They have children. So as soon as you have children in the mix, and I don't have children, but when I talk to parents, especially parents who are in veterinary school, whether you got an A or a B or a C on a test doesn't really matter, when you've got a sick kid at home. You're just doing the best. Yeah. It gives you some perspective. So for them, the red flags are the people who – all their experience on their application is associated with animals. They've wanted to be a veterinarian since they were 4 years old. They have no outside interests that don't involve animals. And so it's a really interesting. And then when you start to talk about that in groups of veterinarians, you see all these light bulbs go on like, oh my gosh, that's me. They're talking about me. Mm-hmm. And again, it's not that we're not a good group of people to be in veterinary medicine. It's just that we need some additional skill sets to help us navigate what is a really challenging profession, especially if you don't have those skills associated with shame resilience. So that's one of the things that Brené Brown talks about. Her research focuses on how do you develop shame resilience. And I tell my students, I've started to use this vocabulary with my students, and I say, here's the deal. There are going to be mean, shaming people in over the course of your career. No matter what, where you are in veterinary medicine, in life, there are just mean, not nice people. You aren't going to change that. What you can change, though, is your response to those people, your inability to let, or your ability to let those people shut you down, right? So I can, at every school, there's going to be that professor who doesn't want to teach, who uses shame, humiliation, and embarrassment as an educational tool, even though the research says there's nothing good about that. There's going to be that professor. I want you to be equipped to be able to interact in a positive way despite that. And there are very specific skill sets associated with that. So we've started talking about that at Western anyway.
That's great. We have been talking a long time, and this is great, and I think we could probably do a part two, because I think what we started getting onto is, which would be a great discussion. I'd love to get some other people involved in this. Like, what can the vet profession learn from other educational formats, other industries, to make it a better program? Because there's one thing that you said, and I'd like to end on this note, because I think this is probably one of the most optimistic things I've heard about our profession, is that if we can teach people better, their capacity to do even more is beyond what we can even imagine right now. And I think we're spending 4 years in school, and they're just getting a lot of stuff drilled down into them and shoved down their throat. And, I agree with you. It's not a very efficient way of teaching. So if you can make it a more efficient way to teach, wow, what prospects there could be for our industry and for the vets coming out of it. And I think that's something I want to ponder on.
Absolutely.
I got to thank you for bringing that up because, and I know that's why I love having you on the podcast because you always get me thinking. And well, maybe we'll talk further about this, but that is a great thought to end the podcast on.
Awesome. And I would just encourage your listeners because this is something that I've just started, you know, just in the last 6 months been talking about. I would love feedback and I'm excited to hear what people think because I think that as we move forward, we've just got to start thinking about how do we create innovative spaces for our profession.
100% agree.
Well, thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. And I will post out on the podcast the links to the Veterinary Leadership Institute and any other contact information for you, Betsy. Thank you so very much. You are doing great things for the profession. Thank you.
Thank you very much.